Good evening, friends. As it was announced, today we are going to take up a topic which is topical in the sense that soon we are going to celebrate our Republic Day. Those of us who were alive or living in those days, those exciting days during national uprising in this country, who have felt the pulse of this arising taking place suddenly over a period of few years during this struggle for independence, we remember with great warmth of heart, but now very sadly, the warmth of heart that there were great patriots suddenly rising on the scene, willing to sacrifice their all, simply because they felt that freedom or independence is not merely a political issue, but is actually a matter of life and death for human existence, for the existence in a sane life, in sensible life. The life of a nation depends upon its sanity. And that sanity can be preserved in an atmosphere of ethical living, an ethical way of life, but also an ethical ideal before us. And therefore, this freedom came to us as a value, as an ethical value. It didn't just came to many of us. I'm saying, I don't mean mere political. Some people who are on the front line of politics, but men like Gandhiji, for people like him, it was a matter of ethical issue, moral issue. So here we are going to give a coloring to this independence and interdependence in this philosophical forum, a philosophical approach to it, a meaning as to what it really means. Not only politically, of course, there is a political shape to it, but mainly what it means to us as individuals and as human society. Gandhiji at one place cites an instance. We are saying Gandhiji because he was, as I said, in the front line of freedom movement. And he said from Confucius. Yes, Confucius. Confucius was passing with his colleagues, with his disciples, through a barren land. When he came across a woman crying before three graves, and he asked her, what is the matter? She says, only last month I lost my husband. And then when he asked, what are those other two graves? He says, first, so many years ago, I lost my son. He was killed by a tiger. Then after a few years, another son was also killed by a tiger. And now my husband has become a victim. And I'm feeling so sad. His colleague said, why don't you leave this place? Why are you going to stay here anymore? She says, but there are oppressive people there. There are oppressive people there. In other words, the country next to that area was an oppressive area politically. So then Confucius turns around to his people, see, an oppressing government, oppressive government, is worse than the tigers. I mean, if you have really felt this kind of oppression, many people felt that, well, the British period was a very rosy period, it was a period of prosperity for the few who were very close to the British. But for the masses, there were famines practically every year in the Bengal areas. And nothing has to be done, nothing was done. So there was therefore a simmering anger going on in the hearts and minds of the people. And of course politicians made a capital out of this. But men like Gandhiji who turned it into a social issue, and as we said, it was a moral issue to Gandhiji. So for him the word Swatantrata means Swadhintata. Swadhinta means Swa Adim, self-reliance. He said, we just don't want merely self-rule, although the self-rule was the word used politically. But the more emphasis in many of his writings were directed to this swadhinta. You have to be adhim on yourself. Depend on yourself. Do not depend anymore, legally, morally, politically, every way to an outsider. That means you must look up, stand up and look up to the British, to whoever confronts you. And be so self-confident, so self-reliant, that nothing should shake your faith in yourself. So this is a kind of moral bend given to the idea of independence. And with that spirit, many of them were really willing to plunge into it. You remember, at least talking personally, in our college days in St. Xavier's, we had a professor of physics who was just released from a prison. He was working for independent movement and he was just released from the prison. And then we found a crowd of students, you see, behaving very loudly. So he just pleaded to them and he wouldn't listen. Then he says, you know, at this very hour, at that time, because it was the year 1944. So he says, this is a time when your sons, your brothers and sisters are lingering in jail. And now you are doing this. You know what it means to remain in prison? And what a sacrifice you have to make, the sacrifice of your career. There are people who have left their career and left it. And you are now doing this way and actually wept in the class. So this is what touched a student of this kind, this student at least. He felt what it means for some people to work for one's country and to seek independence. So it was not merely a political freedom that we needed, a freedom from the shackles from all kinds, physical, moral, intellectual, and social as well as economic. So swadhinta was a great word that was used, and otherwise what it happens, you are dependent on others for every possible things. And this is what has become the Indian side. The Indian mentality has become like this, total dependence. In fact, we loved, we hug above in non-independence. We were just clinging to that kind of life. Because we are happy during the British time, because earlier to that, those Nawabs and other rulers were still worse than that. So compared to them, at least during the British time, there was some sanity of a government. And therefore, we would cling to those British. And we had taken an advantage of it. But the British has exploited us as far as economics is concerned. So that apart, so now coming directly to this, this is why we will consider we have a birthright to freedom. In our Indian old ancient sociology and political science, the word adhikar is never used. The word adhikari is used in one sense. Adhikar means rights. No rights. But adhikari, that means the man of responsibility. He has got certain, is a functionary who has responsibility, and because of that responsibility he has got authority. He doesn't have authority just because he is placed into a particular authority position of authority. He earns authority because he has responsibility. So whatever happens, he is responsible. And adhikari has his duty. And so long as he performs his duty, he has his adhikari. Otherwise, he has no value there. Actually, he is punished if he fails in that. So that if railway accident takes place, the minister of railway minister should be punished. This was a kind of rule of those years. So adhikari means, doesn't mean merely freedom, my right to fulfill. You have to earn it through discipline and through commitments. Now, if you give this kind of meaning to rights, you see, then, and another idea was Dharma Raj. That Dharma Raj means the kind of a king who are benevolent. Essentially, the duty of the king, the dharma of the king, the dharma of the Raja, or whoever be the ruler, was to be benevolent, was to see to the welfare of his people. And with this ideal in mind, the idea of independence and all these things never occurred to those ancients to fight for struggle and all those things. So that if they find that Dharmaraj, if the Raja is unjust, just public would simply remove him. In spite of all the political power that we have, the voice of the people, the will was so great in those days, that they could easily remove people. So with this background, if you see the history of our country, a great country, really Mahabharata, as you say proudly, if you see that whole history, I don't mean the last 1,000 years of corruption and degradation, and if you look at this history, then you will be convinced that we were going to be generated by the time we reached political freedom. And that's why we do not deserve it. You can imagine now at this time in the year 2007, with tremendous uprising in economic, you can call it boom, economic boom. At this very minute, at this very hour, there is 1 in 5 are below poverty line. 1 in 5% are below poverty line. What does it mean? It means starvation debt. It means malnutrition to children. It means 1 out of every 10 child dies before the age of 5. Because of neglect, medical and nutritional neglect. 1 out of every human child in India dies of starvation death. We should be ashamed of this. On one side, there is what we call economic boom. We are proudly announcing it. Why is it now, here, today, this is happening? Because of the lack of moral backbone, lack of moral spine. Therefore, independence is a moral issue. We have to talk in terms of that. So the solution, of course, does not lie with the politicians. We have got wonderful constitution. And after the self-government, this constitutional safeguards are there. But what about the executives who interpret that constitution and apply it? Because they are the same human beings who are the failures. Mr. Crosby talks about the League of Nations during his time. In the year 1818, he writes, it's worth writing, that when the League of Nations was formed, it was useless. It was the same old people, same old wine in new bottle. So he talks of that. Failure. Why failure? Because they are the same people coming up. Others have placed their faith in League of Nations. Yes, they begin to see that though the idea is beautiful, it does not prove out in practice. Why? The members of the League, you can say the same thing about United Nations, the members of the League have each desire to take all they could and give as little as they can. See, they've given that kind of grabbing, taking an opportunist in that League of Nations. And therefore it fails. And therefore United Nations, a League of Nations among similar selfish nations can only bring what selfish interest always brings, disaster. The seeds of war are in it. Mind you, he writes it in 1918, after the World War. He writes the next year. The seed of war is already there in it. So that kind of, even within that League of Nations, there are already the seeds of war. And naturally the Second World War came. This is about the First World War. And then he gives the reason. Why? Where shall we find the true foundation for a changed civilization? That all men and women can see and stand on? Where shall we find such a foundation? It is not philosophies, nor religions, nor political panaceas. Nor political panaceas that are needed. But knowledge and a wider scope of vision than the small vicissitudes of one short physical life. The knowledge that is greater than all the forms of religion ever invented is the knowledge of the very nature of man himself, for himself and in himself. So that means the failure is, as Gandhiji said, well, the whole difficulty was with human nature, the conflict of self-interest. You go to this letters from independence, we have got it here in your reading, that all these great rosy words are used, that you will see. But the member of that United Nations, you see, they say that I must have my own pound of flesh, then there is no such thing as United Nations. There is no unity among them. So in spite of the wonderful preamble with which they start, can you imagine, there is a preamble. The preamble is, already there should be a recognition. It is there in your reading, the fourth reading. Whereas, recognition by the members of the inherent dignity and equal and inalienable rights of all members of human family is the foundation for freedom, justice and peace in the world, etc., etc. This is the background, this is the foundation. Then the article says, but then all beings are born free and equal in dignity and in rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and therefore should act towards one another in the spirit of brotherhood. And therefore should act towards one another. So this is expected. So that of course we are human, as human beings we have got all these facilities. Born free, equal in dignity, with reason and conscience to guide us. We should be brothers. Why is it that we have failed? So the whole difficulty therefore now comes back to us as human beings. Therefore the nature of man. So we as in philosophy always point out, let us first study man. It's very common, the common sense thing is that any social, political, economic problem, even nowadays economists are studying psychology. They think that all the economic forces are governed by human nature. So politicians are also moving with these winds, how human nature works. And mostly it is lower personal grabbing human nature, which is encouraged, which is some kind of a nourished by the politicians, economists, etc., etc. So that means if you need freedom, and of course interdependence, then you must have the knowledge of man. And therefore, we fall back on to the theosophical teaching about man. That at his origin, at his highest level, he is the spark of divinity. No less than a divine spark. A creature of luminosity. Nothing less than that is essential. Whatever may be is out of form, however corrupt it may be, however broken down that individual human being may be. He may be just an animal rolling in dust. But at the heart of him, at the central it is that inner luminosity. In other words, he is an immortal entity dwelling in a mortal case, in a mortal body, in a mortal personality. So the personality may keep changing. It is mortal, it is defective, it has got all its defects lying. But at the core, therefore, he is immortal. Why do we emphasize this? Because true freedom lies there at the center, core. At heart is truly free. In his essential nature, man is born free. When we say man is born free, this is what the preamble says. Man is born free. What does it really mean? It means that in his essential nature he is free. In his outer behavior he may not be free, he is just slave to his own nature. Besides being slave to outside environment and conditions and circumstances. But in his essential nature, man is free, apart from the fact of his free will. So that he has his own conscience, he has got his own reason, he has got his moral sense, as he just read out. And his, of course, inherent goodness, which we say that to be human is to have the quality of charity, justice and generosity coming to us spontaneously and naturally to man. It should come to us naturally, without any effort, effortlessly, if we are truly human. What prevents us? Our own lower selfish nature, the own grabbing nature, the own personality under which we are wrapped up. So apart from that, and then of course because we have got that common origin from that one source, naturally we come from that one source, so we are all brothers and sisters to each other. As the Quran says that Allah is that one father and we are the sons of that one father, therefore we are brothers. This is the logic. Prophet Muhammad Yud said, we have got one father, Allah, who is our father in heaven, and that we are children of that father, and therefore we must live as brothers. essential. So brotherhood is not something that has to be imposed, but it is natural, should be natural, because if you accept the fact that we come from that one divine source, that in our true essential nature we are. Even materially, look at our body. Dust thou art, come to dust thou returnest, as it is said. It's about our constitution, physical constitution. It is made up of dust, made up of these five elements. At the end of life, of course, it is going to go back to those five elements. So even in this outward form also, we are just made up of things which is common to all. Our human nature also is so common. You see, from Dalai Lama would always, whenever he gives lectures, he says, what is a common urge of man? What is a common need for man? What does a man seek? He seeks happiness. He seeks freedom from pain. He seeks freedom from anxiety and fear. And he seeks happiness. That is all that simple thing that human being needs. So if we contrive in such a way, whether it is freedom or whether it is political situation or whatever things you do, if you can think in terms of this happiness for a common man, then it is very easy and simple thing to do. As Madhuri once said, he sent a letter to the parliament saying that, to the legislative assembly, he says, if you are going to legislate any law, before that, keep the mind's eye a picture of a poor man in India, who is nothing else but a poor, not only a poor villager, but an agriculturist. Because 80% of the people are agriculturists in those days. Now, of course, we have turned more to city life. And therefore, whatever legislation you perform, you think how your law is going to affect him and his welfare. This is a very simple Chabi Devi. As Ishwibi also was asked one question, that how shall we arrange our social issues? This is very simple. As to how this is going to influence brotherhood of humanity. Whether it is going to support and sustain brotherhood of humanity, or it is going to disturb it. So any action or any law, moral or legal law, which disturbs that human interrelationship or human brotherhood, then that has to be obnoxious. It has to be discarded. This is one very nice test by which you can judge as to what to do. And you can apply it in our personal life also. That whether this action is going to affect my family, whether this action is going to affect my neighborhood. Yes, it will. If I drink much more, if I am addicted to drinking, addicted to smoking, naturally I am affecting others. So I reform myself so that I may not do damage to others. That is a plain and simple. In fact, that is one of the reasons why every man and woman should marry. Because marriage imposes a certain amount of responsibility, at least to a little group of his own. So that he may become sensitively aware that his life is not his own, but that he belongs to a family and that he cannot do away with it. That every action that he performs has its repercussions on his family life. So responsibility is automatically fallen on a married man or a woman. This is one issue. Similarly, a politician, when he becomes a politician, he must realize that every step that I take has to influence, has to have his influence in the city or in the neighborhood. So with this background, that quotation says that man is a free agent on earth. See, man is a free agent on earth. Why is he free? The second reading says, man is a free agent during his stay on earth. So while he's here, he's free. He's free to make or mar his life. Individually, he can destroy himself if he likes. He's truly free. And he's so free, actually, spiritually speaking, that Rabindranath Tagore in one place says that our great devotion towards God, one of the reasons was that he gives me the permission to deny him. I can even deny God. I can say, I don't believe in you. Go, get away. And God will only smile at him and say, oh, I allow you. It's just like you allow an infant to deny a mother. He says, I don't believe you. You are not my mother. Compassionate. God will wait. You will grow up. When you grow up, you will know I am your mother. The same way, this kind of freedom is given to man. You want to become the wretched person that he is. But then why should he become a wretched person when he has got within his the light of his mind, the light of his conscience, the inner still small life, the voice of his intuitive urge towards the higher. That inborn desire to be good and to be natural, to improve himself, to improve his environment, this is inborn in human being. So man basically is truly a good individual in his own essential nature. Basically good. You must never despair of human beings. Human beings are always good, basically. And with the circumstance, we have contrived to make him what he is today. But a child, a newborn child, is an absolutely pure, innocent child coming straight from the fresh atmosphere of Devasana, from the heavenly world. And as one student friend told me, she was holding my newborn baby. He says, "Oh, lovely, this has just come from heaven. How lovely, what a great privilege to hold a baby coming from heaven." You know, that kind of thrill you feel, that is freshly coming from a heavenly life. This is, of course, a poetic way of looking at it, but it's true. Because we bring with us all our past karmas and past our sanskars and all the ugly things that we have done in the past. But that essential nature we will never, no one can brush it out. It will always remain and it will one day assert itself. One day the goodness in man will assert itself. We will never despair of humanity. The goodness in man will one day assert itself, only it is a matter of time. And therefore the Ismuri says that in the first quotation, why she brought about the theosophical movement on the earth? Because she found when she came, there were three battlefields. She had to wage battle at the three levels. And therefore she said, our voice is raised for spiritual freedom. And our plea is made for enfranchisement, that is liberation, from the tyranny, whether of science or of theology. There is, in those days, you see, the scientific people were putting a kind of blinkers in the minds of people that man is merely a material, made up of material elements, psychophysiological elements merely, and forget about the spiritual side of it. This was a kind of materialistic view. But then, and also the religious view that man is born sinner. What can you do about him? He will require some help from outside. And the church is always there ready to allow you. You make concessions and you have got a ready ticket to heaven, especially at the last hour of your life. But this kind of easy way out was shown by the religious. So that means we have put the blinkers into the minds of men. So this slavery to our false religious indoctrination had to be broken. But then man has got his higher needs. Man has got, of course, his lower needs, as most psychologists would say, that his basic needs is roti, kapda, and makan. That is his freedom from wants, freedom from anxiety, freedom from fear. This is the basic need. He wants security, etc., etc. Happiness, as it is called. But what about his higher needs? There is a yearning in man to improve himself. There is a need. See, even the aborigines who are living cavemen, even they have got that artistic view that they also, within the cave, they used to paint, do that painting and drawing with chalks and with stones and with the muds. This instinct of creativity, the instinct of making things beautiful and pure and clean, is always ingrained in man. So that means the human need has got something else. And one of the greatest things that a man needs is liberty. You see, the three slogans with which the French Revolution started, liberty, equality and fraternity. Each of them will require 1 hour of discussion. What is liberty, what is freedom, what is equality and what is fraternity. But then we, of course, today will limit ourselves to this liberty. What is this liberty with which human being craves, the heart craves? For a society, because for a civilized society, you require some amount of liberty. Liberty for a citizen. Because if we shackle by this law, which are tyrannical, then of course there is no liberty. As Abraham Lincoln, of course, when at the end of the war of independence, he says, but why were you so much fighting for the slavery, fighting for the freedom of the slaves? He says, I would not like to be a slave. I will not like to be a master. A very simple sentence. Yes, I do not like to be a slave. I will not like to be a master. Well, because to be a master means to have slaves. And I know that what a terrible thing it is to have slaves under you. Because it completely emasculates them morally and psychically. Slaves who were so used to slavery in those days, it's said, that when they were liberated, one master, one who was previously a master, he met his own slave in a village. He says, "Now you must be a very happy man now." He says, "No, sir, I've got a lot of difficulties. My roof is leaking and that my food is not as good as I used to give you at your place, and my clothes are not as good. But there is something I still like." He just couldn't explain. "But there is something I still like." But there is some kind of freedom he felt, which is this inner freedom which is so yearning for, to express fully what he wants to express. Because otherwise he couldn't talk to his wife or his child in front of his master. One example. A slave cannot talk to his family member in the presence of his master. That's one simple thing. So like that, there was some kind of freedom in that little hut, though there is poverty. You prefer that. So slaves have become mentally enslaved themselves so much that on the other hand, there were slaves who came back to their masters pleading that, "Please take us back." Because they felt secure under the roof of the master. At least outsiders were not harassing them. When the slaves and men who had undergone imprisonment for 20, 30, 80, for 30 years, if you suddenly throw him into the society, he really feels very difficult to adjust himself to this environment. He is so enslaved to this environment that he doesn't want to come out of it. It's the other one. So man does not want to be free, in other words. This is what Eric Fromm is telling, that actually, basically, human being doesn't want to be free. Everybody wants to cling. I want to cling to my mommy, my own father and mother. And I don't want to grow. If I want to grow, I want to look up to my boss. Somehow or other, I want to lean on earth. So this nature, this slavish nature is there in us, ingrained. And unless we root it out from our nature. So where is slavery? The slavery and the bonds that are there in our own nature. So no use for this swadhinta, for this self-dependence. You see, you require to know where your slavery lies. So our slavery therefore consists in our lower human nature. And Bhagavad Gita says the slavery consists in pandering to our desire nature. Our desire, which causes attachments. See, whenever we have got inclination of his senses, "I like this," our mind is attracted towards it again and again. To that extent we form a habit of getting attracted to it. We have become attached to it. From that attachment comes some kind of a confusion of values. Therefore the loss of memory. The loss of memory of a higher kind, the memory of the spiritual nature of man, which always tells you that this is right and proper. So because of this attachment, a kind of a confusion of values, and confusion of values leads to buddhibhram, that is, loss of memory. And with that loss of memory, the loss of values, the loss of discrimination. And when that buddhi is lost, perhaps everything is lost. So this is a kind of chain reaction. It all starts with this kind of a attachment to little things of life. I cannot live without little comforts of my life. So we are enslaved to this outward sensational life of senses, and even the life of intellectual. We are clinging to certain ideas. And to place upon us during this indoctrination in our schools, in our colleges, at home, certain belief systems to which we are clinging. We are moving in a group. So we are slaves to our own grooves and the habits of life, the habits of thinking and the way of life. So these are the kind of subtle slaveries to which every human being is enslaved, including this student. We are talking about it. But look, we are all struggling together to overcome this, our own inner difficulty. So our own nature, the greatest of them all is attachment. That we are attached to our petty hobbies, hobby horses as that. We like this, and our likes and dislikes keeps us mind bound to our goals of it. And therefore, What is the remedy? The remedy is, of course, that we have to be in control of the world. That unless and until we recognize as individuals that we are not really free, though we are free as a citizen, of course. If I am the head of the family, I am free to do what I think I like. But which is not really true. I am not really free to do what I like because it is going to affect the members of my family. Therefore, responsibility. Therefore, I have to become a responsible citizen. Therefore, the ethical value of responsibility automatically comes by recognition that really I am not free, that I am voluntarily born in a family. I voluntarily made a married life. And therefore, now I am bound to that married issue to which I am bound. And therefore, the duty that comes and arises out of that family are of my own making. Now I cannot blame anybody else. And divorce is not the solution. Even if I want to run away from married life, it's not a solution. Society also will demand certain things from you if you ask for divorce. So, in other words, none of us are really free in that sense. But what about the slavery of a psychological kind? This and the moral kind. This is what we would like to express. Intellectual slavery we have already told you about. But this chapter on happiness tells you, let us then live free from hate and live happily among those who hate. So similarly, free from disease of longing, free from anxiety, free, let us live happily among those who possess nothing. Then victory, that is, people, victorious people, they are also living fear because the enemies are always there at the borderline. So victory does not give peace, victory gives anxiety. And those who are the victims of the victory, they also remain with hatred, they are remaining in anger. So anger, passion, all this anxiety are a drain on our nature. That's why in one of our readings Mr. Judge says that this is a psychological and inner result. Our sense life, our sensuality, our clinging to personal life is a continuous drain on our psychic and spiritual nature. So that we filter away a lot of our energy, making ourselves comfortable, seeking some kind of ambitious goals before our mind's eye and wanting to reach it. And in order to reach it, we will do anything in order to reach it by fair means or foul. To that extent we have degraded ourselves, and to that extent the rebound must come back to us. So ambition is a great curse in that sense. In that sense that because we are ambitious, we become so blind to what is happening to our surrounding, to what is happening to my family, what is happening to my environment, what is happening to my even physical body. So that sometimes when the desire clings to us so strongly, then we become ambitious. We become possessed by our ambition. We become possessed by some of those possessions. So we are possessed by our possessions. And therefore, what Buddha says, empty the boat, for then it will go along lightly. That boat of life should be empty because it is too much burdened with too much of unnecessary cluttered by this. And therefore, this hunger is the worst of diseases, he says. All these are the great statements coming from a great being who has realized that the great enemy of man, the great Mara, is our desire nature. It is this desire that makes us live in this particular fashion. So that politically we may do what we like, so long as the same human beings are coming together and govern, we will have the same kind of government. Therefore our living says, one of our living mentions, HPB says the same thing. We go to that reading. Key to Theosophy, he says, to seek to achieve political reforms, before you are affecting a reform in human nature, is like putting new wine in old bottles. So that human nature, so long as it remains the same, so long the problem remains. Therefore, we end our meeting today with almost a similar thought by Will Durant, that American philosopher. She says, it is not only true that most people misunderstand freedom, but I sometimes think I have not yet met one person who really has rightly understood it. Then he says, the whole universe is absolute law. See, this is fall back upon the very fundamental. Accept this. The whole universe is absolute law. Freedom only opens entire activity and license under the law. If you want freedom, then only opens merely an opportunity under the law. To the degraded and undeveloped, and even to too many of people, the thought of freedom is a thought of ease from law, escape from law. How can I run away from it? Means license, which of course is impossible. Then he says, more precious than all worldly riches is freedom. And he describes this freedom. Freedom from the painful constipation. Freedom from poor narrowness of ecclesiasticism. Ecclesiasticism, that is a theological doctrination. Freedom in manners, that is our habits. Freedom in habiliments, furniture, from the silliness and tyranny of our local fashions. Entire freedom from party rings and mere conventions in politics. And better than all, of general freedom of one's own self. From the tyrannical domination of vices, habits, appetites, under which hardly, nearly every man, every one of us, often the greatest brawler from freedom is enslaved. The greatest brawler from the one who claims for freedom, even he also is a slave. So we are ending this about the idea of freedom, but it is actually an ethical value rather than a political issue. We can have questions, right? Question, because we have not dealt enough on that topic of interdependence. How shall we conduct ourselves that we can be reminded of the fact of interdependence? The fact of interdependence, that is the point. That we have to recognize it. As in our Theosophy school children, we always tell them that over a cup of tea and our breakfast, you can imagine how many people have worked hard in order to procure this cup of tea for you. The milkman has bought it. The producer of tea have made it possible. The producer of sugar have made it possible. This table is being available to you because of a carpenter. So many people have contributed to your personal comforts. So then, are you really free to take away this? What I want to enjoy myself. Bernard Shaw very popularly says that if you want to enjoy yourself, you have no right to enjoy yourself unless until you take into account that others have participated in your enjoyment. That you have to acknowledge it. That you have to acknowledge that you are not really free, that we are so closely interlinked and interdependent. Physically, I am talking about physically, physical life. But our problem is that we have to remember that we have come from that one source, and therefore we are so closely interlinked and interdefected that we are influencing one another, even physically, isn't it? In an infectious takes us a room. We are asked to put on a mask. Because it is possible that in a hospital, they are not allowed even to go there. See, because an infection can spread. So bad things can spread, even the good thing can also spread. So we are all influencing one another at a physical level. But then we are influencing one another at a moral level, at a psychic level. And then unknowingly and unconsciously, whatever that I am doing has its repercussions on others. Unknowingly and unconsciously. The way I carry myself has its influence and effects on others, without knowing. So that as a poet says that you cannot move a blade of grass without affecting a distant star. I mean, this seems to be an exaggeration, it appears. But a poet with his mystical vision, he says, you cannot stir a blade of grass without influencing a distant star. That is going at that level, you know, the repercussions go as far as that. But then how about our immediate environment? So we have to carry ourselves in a certain responsible way. That I am affecting one another, and we are affecting each other. In the way we carry ourselves, in the way we even look at each other, in the way we shake hands with each other. In the very simple gestures, we are influencing one another for the better or for worse. So this is how we have to make up our mind. That I am not going to contribute to this world's happiness. I'm going to contribute to this world's happiness. If I can't do it, at least I will not make myself another scoundrel, as President Roosevelt said. At least there will be one less scoundrel. I will not be wicked, I will not be wrong, because at least let me be one less scoundrel in this company. At least I should be carrying myself, at least let me not do the wrong. Let others do what they want. Because if I do it, and especially when President does it, there is a tremendous repercussion on others. So men in the family, the elders, have a responsibility to their young children, the example that they set. Even the teachers have the example that they set. So these silent influences are so much more than the verbal influences that we have to carry on. And that influence will last. And no wonder the verbal influence is also terrible and great. The power of mantra, the power of slogans. See, when Gandhi says, quit India, when he used that word, Tamil Talo, go, get out. Then he said, death in the year 1942. I mean, it has a vibration, it went out. It has a magnetism behind it, because he said it from the bottom of his soul. He felt that now is the time they must go. And he was willing to sacrifice his all for them. And people immediately accepted that. Because it came from a being of a purity, a pure nature. So if we carry ourselves in a little pure way, in our own little life, a little cultured life, then we are definitely going to influence our neighborhood, or influence our friends. And no matter what repercussion may come back to us, you see, my righteous man will always attract to him good people as well as horrible people around him. They will not him back. Nobody likes good people. They will like to throw stones on him and kill. But all the same, he has got, he will require the manliness, courage, a real quality to go on with this, otherwise he can't succeed. And therefore, it appears that theosophy seems to be a kind of a voice in the wilderness. This may be in the last message, he says that do not let my last incarnation be a failure. She actually preached to us, she wrote a letter and says to Americans, please do not let my last incarnation be a failure, because I am giving you this teaching in your hand. Try and spread it to the best of your ability in order to change the mind of the race. The idea was to change the mind of the race, the buddhi of the race. Slowly it will percolate into the mind of the race. It will take time, it's a matter of time. But it will, they are like the seeds. But don't destroy it. Don't put it on the wrong places. And don't let it go, don't let it waste. So, with those words, we can end, friends, that the theosophical movement was ushered in this world in order to bring about true freedom from within. So that we can live in that way of interdependence, voluntarily and gladly, that we acknowledge the fact that so much has been done by others, for which today if I am safe and secure, it is because so many have contrived, the very legislation has made it possible for me to live safely on the streets. So we have to thank our government to make it safe. We have to thank our environment for making everything possible for us to live comfortably there. Thank you.